Wagwan, everybody. Welcome to the Dis Afemi History Podcast, where we'll be speaking about history and as well family history and how history relates in terms of Caribbean people for the present as well as in the past, and how in the past, what that does and brings forth for what we are going through at present, and what we can learn from our history, from our family, and take that moving forward. So I do hope you enjoy the podcast. And if you like it, please ensure to subscribe, like, and review. Thank you.
In today's episode featuring genealogist Gilles Houdicourt, who has been researching his Haitian family history for 30-plus years and is a founding member, Association de Généalogie d'Haïti. We'll be diving into researching Haitian genealogy, so let's have a listen.
Okay, so thank you so much, Gilles, for coming on to the podcast to speak about the Haitian genealogy group that you have formed. So before we start, I'll have you just do a brief introduction, and then after that, just to talk about how you started this.
Okay, well, my name is Gilles Houdicourt, Haitian born and raised. I immigrated to Canada in 1990 from Haiti. I don't look very dark, I know, but both of my parents were born in Haiti, and so was I. My grandparents on my mother's side immigrated to Haiti. On my father's side, we're a very old Haitian family from before independence, so in the 1700s. I had been living in Canada for a few years, and my father had passed away years earlier, and my mom had been visiting every once in a while. And on one trip, she told me that she had burnt a bunch of papers that had belonged to my father. And I blew a lid when she told me that. I didn't know what the papers were, what their importance were, but I did not. My father died 1 year after I arrived in Canada.
Oh, wow.
So I did not know what it is that she was burning, and I didn't like the idea of that. So anyway, she saw how upset I was. And on the subsequent trip, he brought a box that contained all that was left from my father's papers. In that box, I found a bunch of interesting things, but what I did find was two genealogies, family history. One was an actual tree, you know, like they did in the old days. It was a big roll of paper rolled up that one of my father's sisters had done probably in the 60s or in the 70s, where it was a trunk and, you know, all the branches and all the... I was on it. Little leaves at the tip of a branch, and it had been done by my father's sister, and it was my father's grandmother's side of the family, strictly. So my father's mother, my father's mother. And then my father had, on a bunch of pieces of yellow paper like this, done his father's side. It wasn't a tree. He had taken a bunch of the notes and written all that he knew about his family's origins. And so I took those two genealogies, and I looked for a software, genealogy software. I installed this on my computer, and I entered all the information into a computer from both trees. I combined both. And since my mother had come for the summer, while my mom was watching her soap operas on TV, I had the computer on the desk next to her, and I started quizzing her. My mother was in her 80s at the time. So I asked her a bunch of questions to update all this information. And then I started emailing a bunch of people in the family, asking questions, you know, to update everything. And probably within a few months, I had about 6,000 names. But I went much further than just doing my family's history. Like, I don't know, let's say I had a sister-in-law, or my brother's wife, and I actually happened to know who her brothers were. So I put them in, you know, and then I knew who her parents were. She's not really related to me. She's not directly my family, you know, and her brothers are even less so. Anyway, I put a bunch of information like this with the help of my mother, and it was sort of the beginning of the email, right? We're talking, this is 1997 that I did this. And email had been around for a few years. So I emailed every cousin, every distant relative, everybody I knew, asking questions, you know, date of birth, date of death, date of marriage, where were you born, where were your parents born, et cetera. And eventually, I put all this. I managed to. There's the genealogy software have this common output called the JETCOM.
Yes, yes.
It's a way to export the data in any kind of genealogy software in a common. So that way, if you have a software and I have another one, I can export a JETCOM, which your software will understand, and you'll be able to import it.
Okay.
Okay. So it's like a common language that all the genealogy softwares have. So I was able to import a JETCOM and put it, upload it onto a website. I had created this website, and I could actually put my family tree online. And it was public, and it was free, and a bunch of people could see it. And next thing I knew, I was receiving genealogies from all over the world from Haitians. You know, like I have a family tree and like they had noticed some of their relatives on my tree, you know, and just because like a great uncle's wife, you know. Anyway, so I started inputting all these things and they were all somehow connected because when somebody found my tree, it's generally because they found a relative of theirs. And they would send me information by email.
Mm-hmm.
I got packages in the mail. I received all sorts of information. This one lady had been collecting obituaries and newspapers for years. And she sent me a whole box of obituaries that she had cut out from newspapers that had information, you know? The person who often it mentions who the parents were, the surviving brothers and sisters. Obituaries have all sorts. So anyway, within a couple of years, there was really a bunch of interest, and the people who were most in contact with me, I got in touch with them, and I said, well, let's make something official out of it, you know? And this is why we created l'Association Généalogie d'Haïti, and we registered it in 1990. It's going to be 25 years. So in 1999, it's going to be 25 years in May. We registered here in Canada, in Quebec, in May 1999. And we started recruiting official members. And at that point, we hadn't gone to the archives at all. You know, this was just from word of mouth. This is all genealogy that, you know, people would just get from their families. Often there was mistakes in them, but it was just what people knew about their families. And some of the people who joined our group who were from Haiti were accustomed to going to the Haitian archives and told us that Haiti had many archives that had survived all the different wars and hurricanes and the fires that ravaged Haiti over the years, and that those records were there and that we could consult them. And so somebody went to see the director of the archives in Haiti, a guy called Mr. Bertrand, a very, very good man, honest man, serious. And we asked him if we could have permanent access to these archives to update them in the database. And he agreed. So our members started contributing a little money. We bought a laptop. I had a little computer background. I wrote a little database with a software called Microsoft Access, and which was based on archives document, you know, so it has name, date of birth, date of death, who are the parents, husband, wife, and so forth. You know, anything you can find on a record. And we hired a lady in Haiti, gave her a monthly salary. And every day she went to the National Archives with her laptop, sat down, just opened the oldest books she could find in the beginning. And she started inputting data. You know, so from page one, page two, page three, and whatever she could read, you know, she'd write down. And then we uploaded this to our database, which we already had online from the one I had started. And eventually, some real programmers joined the group and improved the website. And it was improved over the years several times to the point where we have the website that we have now. And it has, I have to check, but I think it has several hundred thousand records now. But there were no pictures. But at the time, digital photography wasn't what it is right now. Mm-hmm. And so I sort of regret that we didn't take pictures of all these archives, but we actually wrote down what they contained. So we'd have even the name of the witnesses, you know, and so forth. And these, you can look them up. And so a bunch of Haitians started finding all this information online on our website and use that to create their own family tree. Okay. Now, the archives in Haiti and in most other countries, the national archives that you could go and freely look up and research, normally are restricted to 100 years to see your birth certificate normally, if I have no reason to do it. They'll ask for you and, you know, why you want this. Yes. For privacy reasons, you know, or for fraud reasons, you know, somebody. But normally when the records are over 100 years old, they can become public. Yes. Because it assumed the people are deceased and so forth. So what we had access to was the archives that were over 100 years old. So we started this in 1999. So we had access to up to 1899. And so the part between you and 100 years has to be done by questioning your family, because you're not going to normally be able to look that up on some website or at the National Archives. So people were able to research, you know, their grandparents, their great-grandparents, and further up. And in certain cases on my branches, I went up to the 1700s, even late 1600s, I haven't.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And that, I mean, you mentioned so many things here. So let's kind of break it down, because you started this group. It's been 25 years. It's coming this May that it's been active. And I'll link that in the show notes as well. Now, if people wanted to join your group, do they have to be in Canada, or can they be almost
anywhere? No. Most of our members are not in Canada. We founded this in Canada because the little core group that started it, including myself, was in the Montreal area. But our members, we have about 250 paying members now. They're all over the world. Most of them are Haitians, but we have people who joined our group because they have to do research for. Recently, I saw somebody joined our group because they're looking for, they're like a law firm, and they're looking for the inheritor or whatever. They're trying to find out, you know, who's going to inherit. So they were researching somebody's family for that. They didn't tell me who or what, but they became members, and they're using our group for that reason.
Oh, that's amazing. And as well, you mentioned the fact that you had somebody in the archives actually going to the archives every day and documenting.
Yes. Now we have two employees. We had started with one employee. She worked alone for many years, and eventually we had her train, but she became very good at it. Like, she could read one of those 1700s documents like it was printed. You know, she's very, very, very good at it. Eventually, she trained another one and then, you know, resigned. And then we had another one. And now we still have two employees. However, ever since the earthquake in 2010, we no longer have access to the old Haitian archives. Okay. Because the building where those archives was damaged. Not the building itself, but all the shelvings collapsed. And all their filing system and everything. And after that, we lost access to that particular, the documents themselves were not lost, but we lost access to that building. We thought it was going to be temporary because the director thought he was going to get funding to fix those old archives. And that money never came. He never found the funding. So ever since 2010, we've actually been using the Mormons' pictures, the microfilms of the Mormon, to continue the work. So we still have two girls in Haiti, each with a laptop, but they're actually going through the pictures done by the Mormons of those same archives, and they're entering all those that information. Every other week or so, I get a Microsoft Access file from them, which we upload to our website. So our website keeps growing every month.
Yes, the database. That's amazing. Completely amazing. And before we get on to with the Mormons, I just wanted to, you know, further reiterate, because you said with the whole privacy situation that it's, you know, when someone is starting their research that they need to talk with their immediate family to kind of get that information before moving on, and how important it is before the.
That's how you have to start.
Yes.
That's how you have to start, is by questioning everyone around you, the elders especially. You know, you have to get as much information from them. And because you don't have online access for recent records, You know, normally in Jamaica, if your grandfather was born in 1935, it's going to be very hard to see his birth certificate if you cannot, you know, show that you're the granddaughter and that, you know, you need this record for some specific reason. And then there's probably a fee, you know, but you can't just go there and browse the records from 1935. They won't let you. Most countries will let you browse up to 1924 or 1923.
Yeah, I know for Jamaica, it's up to 1930 for any births. So anything before that, they'll see. Marriages is 1950 that they'll allow you to see. Okay. And of course, they do allow death records for you to see. I think it's up till 1970 before you start to have to pay for anything that's more recent than that. But yeah, you're definitely right. It does have
it,
to.
It is also a source of income for the National Archives because they charge for this for a specific death record or birth record. And this is how they pay to upkeep their services. So they don't want to just give it out for free. But they only charge for the recent records, not for the old ones.
Exactly. Now, you have a story. I know that would be, you know, in the pre-meeting we had that you mentioned about the Mormons, how they were able to access the archives in Haiti through your group in initiating. Can you just tell us a little bit more about that?
After we started this Association Généalogie d'Haïti, and we started this work in Haiti, and we had good relations with the director of the National Archives, who allowed graciously our one employee at the time to access the National Archives every day. He had given her a desk, and she could leave home at night and leave that. We had a secure lock to leave the laptop overnight, you know, and so forth. We found out that the Mormons go around the world microfilming archives. You know why they do that, huh?
No. Well.
Okay, can I go into that?
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
Okay. The Mormons they're Christians, and they have in their religion a particular belief that when you die and go to heaven, you are not just going to hang around with all the souls of all the living people that ever existed, but you're actually going to hang out with your family. So your deceased grandmother and great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents are there in heaven waiting for you to join them. And because you're going to be hanging out with them in heaven, you have a responsibility to learn who they are. So Mormons, as a religious duty, are expected during their living years to study their ancestors. Okay? So to make this possible for the Mormons throughout the world, they went and obtained permission to microfilm all these records. And they did many, 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 many countries, mostly Christian countries, but they did many countries, which they have on film. And in the old days, you had to go and look them up.
Yeah,
you know, picture by picture, and it was very arduous and very difficult. But now they put all this online. They digitize everything, and they're putting more and more of these things online. And now you can research them by name and by date of birth and by all sorts of information. So the Mormons, to come back, had attempted to go to Haiti before our association was created and were not successful. They ran into all sorts of obstacles. Probably corruption and paperwork and bureaucracy and whatnot. And they had left Haiti without doing any microfilming, and they were disappointed. And we found out about this. So we found out that they had an office here, which is involved in microfilming documents. And we asked for an appointment. And three of us from the founding members of Association Généalogie d'Haïti went to see them. And we said, look, we have very good relations with the director of the archives in Haiti. And we talked to him and he agrees. And we can arrange for you to come back to Haiti and have access to all the archives and be able to microfilm everything with no paperwork, no obstacles, no corruptions, no nothing like that.
Yeah.
And so we put them in contact and they went back to Haiti a second time and they were able to reach an agreement with the National Archives in Haiti. And for many, many years, They actually, what they do is they send all the equipment, the cameras, the film, and so forth, and they train locals on how to microfilm. So they send instructors, okay, who show them how to do it. And then they leave, and it's the Haitian that they trained who actually do the work. There were probably 10 or 12 of them doing this work for many, many years. Whenever I went to the archives in Haiti to see our employee, I would see them in the next room where there were a dozen of them with their cameras and all their equipment. And then they'd send the rolls to, Salt Lake City, Utah. And now all this is online.
Yeah.
All this is online now. So including the archives that we had, many of the archives that we had put on our website, which had no picture. It just had all the information from the acts. But if you go to the Mormon and you can able to find the same one, you'll be able to see sometimes the actual picture, which is very important for many reasons that I'll talk about later.
No, absolutely. It has a lot of information, but still it's just another way for documenting just the fact that your group was a part of that to get the Mormon Church to be able to document and to be able to take pictures. And now it's available online as well, in addition to your group as well, to have a database, a massive database to have all this information, because sometimes it's just not knowing where to go to find things. That's the harder part more than anything else. But yeah, maybe we might want to just kind of look at one of the records, because I know, you know, these records have a lot of information on there, and just to kind of see what people, you know, that are researching can be able to find, and how it will kind of look as well. Because that's the other thing, is when people to kind of don't know what they're looking at or what there can be expected, it becomes a challenge, right? Where people do not like the unknown, so to speak. And yes. What do these things look like, and what am I looking at, and how can I decipher this information to carry me to the next step? So I'll let you bring up one of those records and we can kind of have a look at them.
What I also wanted to mention is that often people who have information about your family history are cousins you haven't even met.
Yes.
You know, so your second cousins have the same great grandparents as you do.
Mm-hmm.
So often, you're going to think of only asking your aunt and uncle and grandparents and brothers and sisters. Then you have your first cousins who are the children of your aunts and uncles. But if you go down to their cousins or their first cousins, they have the same great grandparents as you do. So often you're going to find information, you know, like I didn't have the picture of a certain ancestor, but one of my second cousins did. And it's maybe a second cousin you've never spoken to or that you don't have any relations with, but they have this information and it's your direct ancestor they have information about.
That's right.
So it's very important to reach out to all these people that you know exist, but then you're not necessarily in touch with, to get the information from them. I'll show you some of the records that I dumped them, a bunch of them in this bus. Aujourd'hui, le 7 juillet 1881. So July 7th, 1881. En 68e de l'indépendance, 68th year since Haitian independence, à 6 heures in the afternoon, in front of us, Jean-Joseph Mistel Joly, officer d'état civil. What do you call him, the registrar, l'officier d'état civil of port of the commune of Port-au-Prince, section South, Sud, came the citoyen Lucien Frédéric, born in this city, 26 years old, majeur. Majeur means, you know, 21 over.
Oh, okay, over 21, okay.
Majeur. There's not a word for this in English? It's minor?
A minor, yeah.
And if you're not a minor, you're a?
An adult, I guess. I don't know. Yeah. Okay. That's the only thing I can think of. But
yeah, it's a minor. Yeah. Works for employé public means work for the government. Domicilié légitime du citoyen Dérissé Mélan. Okay, fils légitime, son of the citoyen Dérissé Abélard, and of Rosemère Richier, his wife, both adult, okay, majeur, owners. Owners means you own property.
Okay.
Okay. De propriétaire means owners. So living in this city, and they're acting with the consentement, meaning that the parents approve of the wedding.
Okay.
Consentement de père et mère, meaning the parents are there and they approve the wedding on one part. And this is going to be the bride. This is a wedding certificate. Huh? Demoiselle Marie-Louise, née en cette ville, 22 years old. So born in this city, 22 years old. So also adult, majeur, owner, living in the city, legitimate daughter, fille légitime, legitimate daughter in French means that the parents were married.
Okay.
Fille légitime mean that the parents were not married. Okay. So fille légitime, de feu Calmeuse. So they're saying the feu Calmeuse. Calmeuse is her father, and feu means that he's deceased at the moment. Okay. Okay, so we have all sorts of information now. We know that Karl Meuse was no longer living at that date. See, Karl Meuse and the Célimène Pierre. So we have, it's a wedding. It's one of my favorite acts. And this is why I started with this, because a wedding will give the name of the husband, the wife, and the name of both parents.
Mm-hmm.
And de Saint-Ville, âgé de 22 ans, majeur propriétaire, de feu Calmeuse et de feu Télismamière, oh, both deceased in this city. So now we know that the parents were deceased. The wife's parents at that time were deceased. And we know where they were deceased in the city. Agissant avec le consentement de ses parents, ici présent, both ask us to proceed with the celebration of their marriage. Projected devant l'hôtel. Okay, this is about, in those days before you married, you had to publish it in the church that they intend to marry. So in case anybody opposes, they could. So that's what that part is about, that they had published the intention of marrying. And the other page is on.
So when they published in terms of with marriage, did they have to do that for a certain amount of weeks so they know in?
Sometimes I think it was a few days or a couple weeks earlier, yeah. Because sometimes I found two or three acts like this on the same couple. And the first couple are actually the publications that they have to publish. And they would print it out and put it in front of the church or in front of the mayor's office, wherever. And then the last one is actually the actual wedding.
Okay.
Si j'ai aucune dépension, moi qui aujourd'hui faisais un défaut à l'inquisition. So nobody opposed the wedding. So après avoir donné par la préfecture du chapitre numéro code civil, something about the civil code, des droits respectifs, futurs époux. So this is one of those publications. It's not your actual wedding.
Okay.
Respectivement affirmé, il y a Bella, Marie-Louise sont unis. Oh non! Marie-Louise sont unis par le mariage fait devant nous, Louis-Meuse, citoyen Jean-Baptiste, and then all the witnesses sign. And see here, you can see the signatures of everybody who's mentioned.
Wow.
And see, and you have here, Modeste Udicourt, it's my great-great-grandmother.
Wow.
Yeah, it's my, Modeste is my, it's my grandfather's grandmother.
Okay.
Yes.
What's so interesting about the record is that everything is handwritten. So you know exactly, and it was very specific because, again, it mentions how many years after the independence of Haiti, which
yes.
I find.
It always starts with that.
Yeah.
It always starts with that. See? Here. Aujourd'hui, le 7 juillet 1881. En 78e de l'indépendance. It helps me a lot because sometimes the page is ripped or it's blotted out.
Yes.
Or there's like a watermark and you can't really see the date. But then you can read how many years is there after independence, so you can deduct what the year was. It's so, yeah, this is one of my favorite type of records that we can find is wedding. It has a lot of information. So it has who married who. It's the name of their parents. It has their age. Sometimes it even mentions exactly what date they were born. And often, if the parents were from another city, it will mention that also.
Mm-hmm. No, it's
so then you know where to go look for a certain record.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. Very detailed with all the information. So it's not just kind of like with the British records, only in the earlier part that was written kind of like this. Mm-hmm. But then later on, it became a more formal and chart and everything else like that. But good to know that people were able to sign, everybody that was mentioned signed, you know, mm-hmm. that record, which is, you know, amazing to kind of see that in black and white. Mm-hmm. And here you are showing, again, a very frail document.
Yes, sometimes they're like that, you know, so the information is missing. You have to be very careful when you're taking a picture. You see here, they actually laid it out on a cardboard. And sometimes some of the pages are, okay. So this is my, okay. He was born, this is like five generations before me. This is Senachusu Dikuo, one of my direct ancestors, who had been living with a woman with whom he had three children and for many years. And as he was dying, he decided to marry her. You know, in this case, the officier d'état civil actually came to the house and he married them, and he was on his deathbed and he died the next day. Wow. And I was able to find this record. C'est aujourd'hui, 18 May 1845, 1845, 42nd year of the independence, 11 heures du matin, Charles de Vimet, du magistrat communal, so he's the officer, républicain. So, sont comparus à la demeure du citoyen Senatus. That was his first name, Senatus Indicourt. And it says that he had to come himself to the person's house because he was sick. Maladie qui l'empêche, that prevents him from himself going to the officer's office. Le citoyen Senatus Indicourt, natif du Port-Républicain. So, Senatus Indicourt, born at Port-Républicain, which is Port-au-Prince's old name, age 38. So he didn't die very old. Propriétaire, commerçant, so he's a business person. Domicilié en cette ville. Fils naturel, so his parents were not married. So fils naturel de la citoyenne Marie-Louise Udicourt. And that's all it says. We never forget to find out who the father was. So my name is Udicourt. I descend from him, Senatus, and I know that his mother was Marie-Louise Udicourt. I know who Marie-Louise Udicourt's father was and mother, but his father, I never found out who it was, and I never probably will. And then he marries Elisabeth Azor, natif du Port-au-Prince. This is the oldest ancestor whose picture I have. I'll show it to you in a little while. Elisabeth Azor. We have actually, it's a painting. It's not a photography. It's a painting that we have in the family of Elisabeth Azor of Port-au-Prince, 37 years old, etc. So, and then, is there a page two? Yeah.
The writing is so beautiful on here.
Yeah. So, and then the witnesses sign, and I don't know whose signature is here, but yeah.
And so you've posted everything on Family Search.
Yes, on Family Search I have. And this is Elisabeth Azor.
Amazing.
Let me get the.
And how were you able to obtain this picture?
We had this picture in our family. It was at my aunt's house for many years. And it took me a long time to track it down because my aunt died. My aunt, who was in possession of this picture, died in the late 70s. Everybody in the family, the elders, knew this picture. It existed, but we couldn't track it down. And it actually, it's only about in the last 7 or 8 years or so that I was able to find the picture. It was boxed by one of her children, and then a great-granddaughter had it, and she finally found it in the boxes. And so there he is. This is Elisabeth Azor, born around 1806. So she's the wife of Senatus Udicourt, who was born in 1806 as well. her. I wasn't able to find anything on her. I have her wedding certificate. I have her death certificate, which I was able to find. Mm-hmm. I have the birth certificate of her three children, two of which died when they were young. Only one got to become an adult, and who's my great-great-great-grandfather. But her parents, where she's from, I was never able to discover. It's one of my dead ends. But I have her picture.
You have a picture. That's more, that's a, like a thousand, that's like $1 million to get a picture.
What I've also done, I'll go ahead and mention it while I'm on her, is I went to the cemeteries and took pictures of tombstones.
Okay.
And that's one place that you can also find interesting things.
Mm-hmm.
And dates, for example. So, sorry. Clicked on the wrong thing here.
Okay.
Elizabeth Azor, back on her file. There it is.
Okay.
What happened here? There it is. So this is my family's tombstone, and one of the tombstones on the Udicourt vault in the Port-au-Prince Cemetery. I went there, even though everybody said I would get kidnapped or murdered if I went. That was quite a few years ago, but it was already dangerous. And there she is, Elizabeth Azor, wife of Cincinnatus Udicourt, 1807-1864. And her husband is right here, Cincinnatus Udicourt, 1806-1845. He died the day after he married her.
Wow, oh my goodness. And these are all the children.
This is all. So he's the one who built the vault, Cincinnatus. And this is his wife, Elizabeth. Tilly Smar is one of the children they had who died when he was 13 years old. Actually, he's probably the first one who went in the vault.
Oh, wow.
Because you see, he died in 1943.
Mm-hmm.
And this is Augustin Jean-Baptiste Udicourt, who became general at the time of his death, who was their child, who was 1886. So he's my grandfather's father. And then I have a picture of him as well. And Rose Flora Modeste, you saw her signature earlier. The first act I showed you, there was a signature, and it was her, who was at the wedding as a witness. And she died in 1907, born in 1840. So it was his wife. And this is Agibé Udicourt, fils, is their son. So there's several generations in this book, like five, six. My father's there. So you see, the source of information is very diverse. What we also find often on the Mormons is ship and aircraft manifest. Sometimes you will find somebody who traveled on a ship in 1880. And often, if you find that person and you know you're related to that person, you can go see who were they traveling with. And often on the manifest, it's going to say, this is the husband, this is the wife, these are the children, and these are their ages, and this is their profession. I found a bunch of manifests. A lot of them come from Ellis Island, New York.
Yes.
Where they photographed and digitized all this information. I found quite a lot of information on the manifest.
Yeah, definitely on the manifest, especially when not only on that first page of the manifest, but as well the second page, because it will really give a family member that they know from where they're coming from and ties in to say, oh, this is who, and this, you know, a cousin or an uncle or whoever it may be. Mm-hmm. But again, another tying piece for everything. And it's wonderful to know that these documents actually existed, because I'm sure most people would think that after the revolution that there would have been very little. Now, most of these are going to be in the Haitian archives. I know you mentioned before, you know, in our pre-talk, in regards to some of these being in the archives in France. How much actually got caught up, I guess, in France?
This is the colonial times. Before Haiti became independent in January 1st, 1804, when Haiti, at the time called Saint-Domingue, was a French colony, they would make two copies of every act and send one copy to the National Archives in Paris. Many of them made it and are still there. And you can also research them on a database called online called ANOM, A-N-O-M. But often those records did not make it. Either the ship sank in a storm, or often it was intercepted by a British warship. So there are some records in Haiti which never made it to France. Some records in France still exist, but the one in Haiti was lost in a fire, in a war, or in a whatever. In rare times, we find the records exist in both copies. I have found some records in Paris, which also exist in Port-au-Prince.
Mm-hmm. No, I definitely agree there. It is rare that they'll exist in both, even though they should.
I came here, I put this picture of the signatures.
Yes.
Signatures, when available, are very important, especially when you have a common name. Yeah. Okay. If you're looking for Modeste Ducour, it's a very rare name. Most likely, it's unique. Mm-hmm. Okay. But if you have a more common name, John Smith, okay, or Michael Lewis, or a name like this, and you can go on a database and then you find 100 of them. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them are born around the same time in the same city. Some are related to you if you know you have Michael Lewis ancestor, but many or most are not. This is where little details like signatures, addresses, witnesses become very important. When you have a document which you know is related to an ancestor and there's a signature, take a picture. Mm-hmm. Okay? Because if you find another record and you don't know if it's the same person, you can go and compare the signature.
Yes.
And then that'll confirm or confirm that it's not the same person. Often a record will have an address. They'll say living at 23 Cooney Street. Take note of that. Because when you find another record and you're not sure it's the same person, mm-hmm. you know, 6 years earlier or 6 years later, but then it says 23 Cooney Street, you say, aha, this is my great-great-grandmother. Another thing to note is the name of the witnesses. Mm-hmm. Because often the witnesses are not relatives. Sometimes they are, but often they're not. Or when they are a relative, they don't say how they're a relative. It's a different name. You have no idea how they're relative. And it's not important when you find one record, but often the presence of that witness will allow you to identify another record that you're unsure of because it's the same name and it's the same witness.
Exactly.
So you have to note all the, when you have a known document, which you know belongs to your family, you have to take note of all these little details. And it's all those little details that will make you connect the dots and fill in the puzzle and be able to identify all the records that are related to your family.
Exactly. Because sometimes with those witnesses, they are neighbors or people that have some sort of business relationship with that you'll see in other documents as well to know that that's how they're connected and that's how things go during that time.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, you just wanted to bring up this manifest? This is the
shipping. Oh, just an example of a manifest. Well, this one, I didn't learn anything. This is an uncle of mine. Let me see if I can find a manifest, which is, oh.
As well, because the islands were so close, like Haiti,
mm-hmm.
Cuba, and Jamaica, I mean, I too have some French family names that I'm sure would have come over from Haiti to Jamaica.
Yes.
And vice versa, because there was a lot of movement during those times, and especially between islands. And just to know that, I know on one branch, they were born in Cuba, but they were raised in Jamaica. So, I mean, just to know that there is that connectivity between, especially those three islands, and of course, with...
especially in a time when people took sailboats to go from one place to another, you had a tendency of doing business and buying things and with your neighbors.
Yes.
So there were a lot of exchanges between Jamaica and Cuba and Jamaica and Haiti or Saint-Domingue, which was called the French colony. sometimes even when there was war between the colonial powers in Europe, there were still exchanges going on between the colonies here. Then during the Haitian Revolution, a lot of French families and their slaves fled to Jamaica. Many fled to Cuba. Many fled to Dominican Republic. Yes. And Louisiana, New Orleans, was practically founded with refugees from Haiti.
Yes.
When the Haitian revolutions occurred. This is where the Cajun language comes from in New Orleans. It's actually Creole from Haiti. And all these French traditions were brought over. It was people of all color. Huh? Frenchmen, white French people came, mixed people came, black people came, and also of all conditions, because in Haiti, often people don't know that during the colonial period, I'm sure it's the case in Jamaica, I don't know so, but I'm certain it's the case in Jamaica as well. Often black people were slave owners. It's not the typical, what we think is the typical white person owning black people. That was not the case. Often, black people, when they became free, the way to move up in the world was have a plantation or have some sort of domain where you had to raise things and you needed labor. And how did you get labor back then is you bought slaves. Sometimes they bought their own relatives to get them out of slavery, but they were just owners of slaves as well. And slaves were not necessarily black. Often, people would have children with their slaves. It wasn't necessarily the plantation, the master's children. You know, like he could have some guests come over and he'd lend them one of the girls from the plantation to share his bed with at night. And when this girl had a baby, it wasn't the slave plant, the plantation's owner's baby. It was just some guest he had overnight 6 months earlier or 9 months earlier, who was the father, and he didn't really care much about that baby or taking care of him. And that baby stayed in slavery. So we had mixed race slaves, even very, very light colored slaves, sometimes which were like one quarter black and three quarters white, and they were still slaves.
Mm-hmm.
So we could have a slave owner, pure black, owning an almost white slave, somebody who was like three quarters white and one quarter black. So it's not what we typically see in the movies or that we read in the books. We had all tones of people and all conditions. And so the people who fled the Haitian Revolution, sometimes who went to New Orleans, were the white people with their slaves, who could be white or mixed breed. It was colored people who were free and sometimes also fled with their slaves, which could be practically any color except white. Yeah. And we had actually black slaves who fled the revolution because they were slave owners and they owned a certain number of slaves and they realized they would lose all of them. So they preferred fleeing the revolution and moving to a place like New Orleans or Baracoa, Cuba, or indeed Kingston, Jamaica, mm-hmm. and establish themselves there so they could keep their slaves, which was expensive property, and continue exploiting them.
Yes. No, for sure. I mean, that is a narrative that isn't very well spoken of, and people are kind of surprised. And definitely what I studied in my records of, you know, see, you know, somebody sell their own children to pay their taxes is quite astonishing. But those were the times. I mean, that New World Order was in human flesh, and that's how they were unfortunately seen. So it's just one of those things. But yes, it's just, you know, uncovering all of those documents, seeing those things. But as I said, as I told you already, I think it's just quite fascinating that every year on each record, they indicated as to how many years since the revolution, meaning that that was a very important event and it meant something for them to document that on every single record moving forward. But, you know, going to your group in terms of what other, I guess, support that you offer to people that are researching their family tree?
Okay. Our group does not officially really offer any support to help people. We provide these two databases.
Okay.
So one is a genealogy database, mm-hmm. and one is a database of just straight records, birth, deaths, marriages, divorces, and so forth. So we give them access to these things and they can research. And we used to run a forum years ago, but it shut down. And now there's a group which is not directly, it's not our group, but I'm a member of it. It's a Facebook group, which has several thousand members. And I work a lot with them. And on this group, you can actually become a member of that Facebook group and ask questions and ask for help. And there's, or ask, like, I can read these documents because I'm used to it. But sometimes some people run across one of those documents. And especially like if it's a second generation Haitian in the States or in Canada, in Canada, they often speak French, but like a second generation Haitian in the States would likely no longer speak French at all. And then this document's in French, and then they come and help. They said, okay, I found this document. It's my great-great-grandfather, but can you help me read it? Okay, so right away, somebody in the group will pitch in and translate the document and read them and help them, you know, give them also pointers on where to research, how to research, etc.
No,
so this Facebook group has about 77,500 members.
Wow.
I think right now, yes.
Amazing. And then, you know, just so we can end this discussion, what other final thoughts that you wanted to give that we didn't mention already?
Okay. We found this one. It was my grandmother's. Okay. And my grandmother would write all sorts of information on our family Bible. Okay. Who died, who married who was born. And we have pages and pages and pages in my grandmother's Bibles with all sorts of valuable information. It's one of my cousins who was able to locate this Bible. I don't know who had it, but I started this. I have been doing genealogy for 15 years before somebody popped up with this Bible. And it provided, probably people don't do that much anymore, but our grandmothers did.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is a document if you're doing genealogy and you have one of your cousins who may have a grandmother's Bible like this, it's gold. It's a gold mine.
Okay. Yes. Yes. Absolutely.
You see.
So, if you wanted to share that.
So here it is. This is a page from my grandmother's Bible. I have to actually close and open them.
Mm-hmm.
I just have the pictures of a few of the pages. So this is the owner of the Bible. So she put herself. Her date of birth and place of birth. She was born March 19th, 1876. And somebody wrote, probably her husband, because he died after her, 6th of August, 1939.
Okay.
And see, and they were married 12th of October, 1903, by the pastor Bellegarde. Belland. My grandmother was, grandfather were Methodist.
Okay.
And so here's a few pages from the Bible. See, Marianne Mauduit-Dicourt, born in Jérémy, 14th of June, 1904. See, there's all this information on the different pages. It's very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Very detailed as well.
Yes. Marie-Catherine, and this is my father, Jean-Charles Pierre-Dicourt, born in Port-au-Prince, 23rd of June, 1912.
Wow.
So this is another source of information
that
you can find that's very, very important for family research.
Definitely. Yeah. We just don't think that something like that, but once you're researching, it gives another, I guess you can say, kind of fleshes people out, so to speak, and it gives a different personal touch to things. As you can see, they try to keep it as best together as they could by putting tape. But I mean, it's just one of those things, and it's just one, I mean, I do feel, you know, going on this type of a journey, it definitely just uncovers and just sees so much of what was done to ensure that information got passed on to the next generation.
We should also mention that we have to question our elders, and often our elders are not forthcoming.
Yes.
Because they always have things to hide, things that they think are not respectable or that does not, you know,
mm-hmm.
Everybody had children without being married, and often somebody had a child on the side, and so people had half sisters and half brothers, and that has always happened.
Yes.
you know, and our parents and grandparents always make us, you know, want to believe that they were prim and proper and et cetera. And they don't want us to know all these little dirty little secrets, but they know about it, you know? Yeah. So if they know, why can't we know?
Exactly. Yeah, one of the things that may have occurred as well. So,
especially now with DNA, like I've done DNA tests with two or three different companies, you know, and now I didn't have any big surprises myself, but I have relatives who had huge surprises, you know, and then you come and confront the person and say, hey, you know, look what the DNA shows and, you know, what's the story here?
Yeah. And it could be, you know, if someone's not ready to even, you know, think of that information to say it's so different from what the narrative that they were told, mm-hmm. that can be extremely life-changing in a very negative way as well. So mm-hmm. not only potentially positive, but it could be definitely a very negative way because it changes their whole vision of their life or what it, you know, what it was up to that point before having that test.
But sometimes DNA will reveal a secret from 100 years ago. It's not necessarily that your father is not your father or something like that. You know, it's just that somebody who should have been your second cousin tests negative.
Yes.
Okay. So this is going back to the great grandparents. And you go, whoa, you know, or somebody who shouldn't have has Spanish ancestry, you know, and where's the Spanish ancestry comes from?
Coming from, yeah.
And somebody who was supposed to be a good friend, okay, suddenly is a cousin. And you look at their tree and your tree and like, no, you're not connected on the tree, but you're second cousins, you know, so you have common great-grandparents.
Exactly.
You know, and that helps you do the research. So it's not necessarily something that's going to create trauma in your immediate family, but it helps a lot. It's a very good tool.
It's a good tool. Mm-hmm. It's a good tool. So, but you know, for some people, as I said, can be life altering, right? So,
yes.
But no, I just wanted to thank you so much for coming on and talking about this. And of course, talking about in terms of researching in Haiti and what that is entailing and what, you know, as I said, I'll put your group's information in the show notes so they can be able to access that. And of course, Family Search and anything else. And I think you mentioned the other one for the French archives as well. Anom.
Anom, yes. A-N-O-M.
Oh, Anom. Okay, Anom. Okay, perfect. Yeah, I'll put that there so that can be done. But no, thank you so much, Gilles. I really do appreciate your time and your expertise to kind of go through those documents because, again, for people to see what can be, what they'll actually be able to uncover because that's the biggest thing. To understand what document am I looking at and how do I read it and understand it. So, again, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It was nice talking with you.
Hoped you enjoyed this episode. And if you did, please make sure to like, follow, subscribe, and write a review for the episode wherever you listen to your podcast. Thank you.